This is Lee Rocker, and you're listening to Walking the Floor.
I'm walking the floor over you.
Walking the floor.
I'm walking the floor.
Walking the floor over you.
Hola, senores and senoritas. This is Chris Shiplett, and you're listening to episode 205 of Walking the Floor. It's a gloomy, rainy day here in Los Angeles, and as I tape this, got a busy week out in front of me. We're going out to Cleveland to go do some fun stuff around the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame thing. So by the time you listen to this, that'll all be over, although I don't think it would have aired yet, so I don't know. Not sure when that's going to be out there for public consumption, but it's exciting. Exciting week. Looking forward to it. I got to tell you, today's interview is the last interview that I have sitting in the can, kind of waiting to be edited and posted, and I don't really know what I'm going to do moving forward. There's a few other interviews that I want to get to, but I will tell you, I've been kind of working on a new podcast idea that's kind of a different thing, and I think I might put this one on the back burner for a little while and take a break from it so I can get this other thing going and off the ground. But I don't know if I'm going to do that just yet. I'm kind of unsure. I haven't really made up my mind. So I'm going to get through this week, get this one posted, maybe see about interviewing a couple other people, or maybe not. I might just, put it on hold for a little while. I don't know. Let me know what you think. Should I keep going? I kind of don't have the time to do all the stuff that I'm trying to get done right now, which is finish a record, start a new podcast, be a Foo Fighter, you know, be a dad, be a husband, be a this, be a that. So I don't know. I'll keep you in the loop as we go forward. That's very vague. I'm sorry. I'm not like speaking in dumb, like vague business speak, but I don't really know what I'm doing. So we'll see. I'll get back to you. How about that? I'll let you know. Anyway, let's do some business. Okay. Is there something that interferes with your happiness? Like, is something out there preventing you from achieving your goals? If so, you really ought to check out BetterHelp.com/walkingthefloor. BetterHelp will assess your needs and match you with your own licensed professional therapist, where you can start communicating with somebody in under 48 hours and connect with them in a very safe and private online environment. It's, of course, anything you share is confidential. It's super convenient. It's affordable. And it is not a crisis line. It's not self-help. It is professional counseling done securely online. So, I want you to start living a happier life today. And as a listener, you'll get 10% off your first month by visiting our sponsor at BetterHelp.com/walkingthefloor, where you can join over 1 million people who have taken charge of their mental health. Again, that's BetterHelp, HELP.com/walkingthefloor. And boys and girls, once you do that, make sure you get on over to Zounds.com, because, when you get your mental health together, then you got to go do some rocking. And you got to buy some picks, and you got to buy some guitars, and you got to buy some keyboards and drums, and practice your paradiddles and your arpeggios and whatnot. And Zounds is the team that's going to help you do that, because they've got 3 warehouses strategically located all across the United States, so you get your gear faster than anybody else. There's free shipping on every order with no exceptions and no exclusions. And the reason that they're the best online, music retailer out there, music gear retailer, is because Zounds staff are all musicians. Zounds.com. All right, let's get on over to today's interview. All right. Anybody that's listened to my podcast over the years knows I'm a gigantic Stray Cats fan. I've interviewed Brian Setzer. I've interviewed Slim Jim Phantom. And on today's episode, I finally get to complete my epic Stray Cats trilogy by interviewing Mr. Lee Rocker, bass player extraordinaire. And he was such a cool, mellow dude. So much fun to talk to. I've been a huge fan of his and Stray Cats since Built for Speed first came out. And we talk about that era and the sort of MTV-fueled rise to fame, and about how they've broken up and gotten back together over and over through the years, and we even talk about contemporary ballet, which I think is where we start this thing. So make sure you listen to his latest record, Gather Round. This is Mr. Lee Rocker on Walking the Floor. She never gives me bitching, magic in the kitchen. So she'll stay just one more day. So I saw that that some songs off your new record, Gather Round, were commissioned by the Laguna Dance Festival. What's that all about?
That's, you know, an interesting thing. You know, I mean, obviously this pandemic year, everything's got to be done a little different, and including getting music out. And I was contacted by Laguna Dance Festival, and they're related to another company called Complexions out of New York, which is a contemporary ballet. They're an offshoot of the Alvin Ailey ballet. And over the last couple of years, they've taken, you know, rock music or different types of music and commissioned ballets to them and performed them. And I, last year, right before the pandemic, I went to see them at the Joyce Theater in New York, and they were doing Lenny Kravitz, and it was great. And it was different and kind of really opens your eyes, you know, different interpretation of the music and just, you know, people moving to it in a different way. So I was aware of them, and they just got a phone call or an email a number of months later saying, hey, we'd like to do this and film this. And then when they get back to live performances, they'll incorporate this into their, you know, this 2022 season.
So is that something where they take your music and then actually write the ballet like to it?
Exactly. This Dwight Roden is a fantastic and well, you know, renowned choreographer. And he really is the one that came up with this. And this is a duet, really. It's a male and a female dancer. And they took three songs off of my newest record, Gather Round, and they're doing modern ballet to it. It just premiered last night online. And I was lucky enough to be at the filming a few months back in New York. So I was there. It was actually a pretty emotional thing in a way. It's the first time I had been in a theater with a stage. I mean, although it was just a handful of us, but actually in that environment and seeing live people, you know, performing. And it was amazing.
Yeah. What's that like? I forgot.
it was crazy. I mean, and it shouldn't have been, but it was definitely it had an effect. I mean, yeah. I have to say, down on 19th Street, I'm trying to remember the name of the theater, but, you know, there was a couple of lighting guys and a couple of camera guys and the two dancers and the choreographer and myself. And, it was cool.
Yeah. Do you get back to New York much?
Yeah. I split my time between Southern California and New York City.
Oh, you do?
Yeah.
I thought you were full time in Laguna Beach.
No, I'm back and forth. This is the main home, really. But I'm usually, you know, 4 months in Laguna, 4 months in New York, and 4 months on the road. It's kind
right.
of in the old days, that would be right. a typical year, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Broken up, you know, split up. It's not blocks of time, but
how did you wind up in at least some of the time in Laguna Beach?
Well, I grew up in New York. I'd lived in London. I'd lived
sure.
in LA and New York City. And basically my wife's dad had a house in Laguna and we would visit him and just thought it was fantastic. And when we had kids, we said, this is really where we should plant ourselves. So it's a great, great beach town. It's beautiful.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's awesome.
I mean, I'm a Southern California native. This is kind of a roundabout way of getting to asking you if you've taken up surfing yet. Everybody I know in Laguna, I mean, the drummer for the Foo Fighters, Taylor right. Hawkins, is a Laguna native. He was born, or not born, but he was grew up down there. And so I know a lot of his friends from Laguna, and everybody's in the surf world, and I surf. And so I know you're from Long Island, so like, you might be a surfer. You could have grown up going to Rockaway. I mean, who knows?
I hate to say it, but I'm not. I do like the beach, but I'm not a surfer.
More of a skimboarder.
Yeah, I just float.
Nice. Hey, I saw in I was looking at some promo pictures of you, and there was a couple where you had like a really nice drape coat on, and it reminded me of a beautiful drape coat that I got a few years back from Glenn the Tailor. And I know that you know Glenn, that of course, you know, because I know he worked with you guys much. Do you still get clothes made by that guy?
Yeah, Glenn Palmer, Glenn of Hollywood. He's fantastic. And yeah, I do. It's been a little while. But the custom clothes thing, it's either, for me, it's either Glenn or Manuel in Nashville.
Oh, yeah, sure.
You know,
at what point in Stray Cat's existence did Glenn come into the fold? Or at what point did you start getting clothes made?
It was pretty early. When we started, it was all vintage stuff and thrift stores and vintage clothing. And I still love that. And probably, probably when we started to sell records.
Right. I mean, when you think of, like, I'm assuming you first were getting into rockabilly sometime around like the late 70s or so. Like, was it because, you know, like I'm a little younger than you. So like in the 80s, there was still a lot of cool stuff in thrift stores, but by like the 90s, you know, it's all just impossible to find anything. Yeah, everybody knows what's out there and everybody's found it, and it's all been, you know, it's being sold for a lot of money. But like when you were a kid and you were first kind of defining yourself that way, would you go into were thrift stores just a wonderland of bowling shirts and bitchin' old suits and stuff?
It was unbelievable. And I, as a teenager, I had some friends in the thrift store vintage clothes kind of business, and they would buy clothes by the pound. I mean, it would just be giant trash bags. And, you know, they'd go through and go, wow, look at this. Wow. And, you know, something would be thrown in the forget it pile, and then there'd be a pile of great stuff, you know? But yeah, I mean, it was like, buried treasure or something. Gabardine bowling shirts and pink suits and, you know, I mean, just fantastic stuff. And it's definitely gotten harder and harder. I mean, there are now, it's, you know, collectors and
sure
thing. But the stuff amazingly is still out there, you know.
You can still find like the real 50s stuff.
Yeah, although, you know, a lot of, you find like a pink and green suit and it's, you know, for a 500 pounder, you know, so you're just
right
who actually had that suit in the first place, you know.
The Teddy Boy look was like a specific thing, like with the drape coats and all that. That's like pre-rockabilly. Isn't that like British pre-rockabilly?
Yeah, that's good. It is. And rockabilly. And it's very Edwardian, some of the clothes and how the look is of them. But yeah, I mean, those Teddy Boy suits are fantastic. And Glenn Palmer and Manuel, I mean, we've had a lot of those. I've had a ton of that stuff made over the years, the Kentucky Colonel ties. And,
yeah. Like, was that like when you guys, you know, obviously you started in New York and then moved over to England, which I know the famous story kind of based on, like, hey, rockabilly is still popular, that kind of thing. Like, were you aware of all this of like the nuances and the sort of the British version of it versus the American version of it?
Hell no. I mean, I don't think we knew anything. I mean, literally, with the Stray Cats, we started in New York, Long Island, you know, out in the suburbs, and we played CBGBs and Max's Kansas City. We'd go into the city and do those, and it was sort of the end of punk. And, you know, we had heard at that point, all the news that I got was from the NME and the Melody Maker and these British rock and roll newspapers that would come out once a week. And, you know, you just see things, you know, about the Clash or, you know, the bands that were happening at that time. And we literally didn't know anything. There was no planning. There was no management. We bought 4 airline tickets, you know, 3 for the band and 1 for my bass. And we went to London. We were kids when I was 17 years old. I guess we were either dumb enough or smart enough that when we got to customs, we all got in a different line. So they didn't, you know, they go, oh, are you a student? I'm carrying this upright bass. I said, oh, yeah, that's what I am. And they put us through. And we slept in Hyde Park. met people and knocked on doors. And, you know, some of these places, these pubs and different rock and roll venues looked at us in our, you know, Teddy Boy rockabilly clothes and being teenagers with New York accents, and gave us, you know, gave us a shot, and things really came together quickly, but there was no plan. I don't think there was any pre-knowledge of, wow, there's a scene going on.
Right.
And there wasn't a scene going on in the States. I mean, people, people loved the band from the start. We knew the Stray Cats had a certain power and an effect on an audience. And that much we knew. But there was no scene. I mean, the audience probably thought we wrote Blue Suede Shoes.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. That's great, man. Take that all day long.
Thank you, Carl Perkins, you know?
I mean, did like, I know that there were some like UK rockabilly bands at the time. And obviously the UK has always had a deep appreciation of like American roots music and stuff. So were the what little rockabilly bands and stuff and whatever kind of scene was around, did they sort of welcome you with open arms, or was it like, I'll get the fuck out of here, you're taking our thing, or what, you know what I mean? Like, you guys must have looked like you just landed from outer space or something at that point.
There was definitely more people who knew the term rockabilly, and there was a little scene in England, and there always has been, you know, Shakin' Stevens and Matchbox and some of these bands, but it was a funny thing at that point. You'd get some of them that we wouldn't be pure enough rockabilly, you know. They would literally, it's insane. They would literally want you to copy the mistakes of the original artist. You know,
right.
Add note on a solo that, why didn't you hit that note? It's like, it's, but you know, we were embraced pretty quickly, I gotta say. But there was definitely the sort of some of the Teddy Boy ones that, you know, they treat rockabilly, probably still do, like a museum piece, and you've got to take it off the shelf and dust it off, and it's this thing, and it's not. I mean, it's like any other kind of music, whether it's jazz or bluegrass or straight up rock and roll. You want to do your own thing to it, and you want to play with it and screw around and you know, not just walk over the same ground over and over again. Or at least that's
sure
I try to do.
Well, how do you, it's interesting. You know, how do you think the experience of being there influenced you guys and musically influenced you guys?
The exposure to everyone else. I mean, there's always, maybe not now, but there's usually a geographic place in rock and roll where it's going on, whether it's New York City, you know, in the 70s, London, in the early 80s, Seattle. And at that point in time, summer 1980, we moved to London, and everything was going on, and it was just exciting. I mean, we were, and it was defined things, but all the bands were working together. I mean, I remember doing Top of the Pops with Motorhead, Susie and the Banshees, Duran Duran and the Stray Cats. I mean, it was just,
wow.
And a lot of the shows. So it was super cool. And especially in the early days with the Cats, we really had a punk edge to what we were doing. I mean, I listen back now, and like, we played some of these songs so fast, it was incredible. They'd last, you know, a minute and 35 seconds.
right. I mean, those early, the footage of the early Stray Cats shows in Europe just look fucking mental. It just looks like it's, you know, it's so revved up and supercharged. I mean, the original rockabilly shows could not have been possible. Been like that, you know.
It was a moment. I mean, it was amazing, I gotta say. And that's really where my career and the Cats, I mean, really launched. We were embraced by the Rolling Stones and you know, Robert Plant and you know, just so many people came down to our really early concerts and were in touch with us and loved it and did us they helped shine the spotlight on what we were doing, to be frank, you know. So it was really kind
sure.
of a, it was really kind of a great thing for them all to have done. One of our very early shows, when we were basically living on the streets there, all of the Stones showed up at a place called The Venue, and they had a table in front of the stage. And so the paparazzi, and, you know, it was off the hook.
I mean, in those days when sort of popular culture was so much less diffuse, you know, from technology and everything, like a moment like that, how did that impact your band? Like in terms of like being able to get a record deal and get more gigs and get tours, like, cause I had to assume that like that pictures of that show and those guys sitting there, that goes in all the NME and all that stuff.
Oh, like, yeah. It became, you know, a frenzy. You know, I'd never met anyone from a record company or a proper, you know, booking agency or anything. You know, booking agency was knock on the door, you know. And people from A&R guys, who didn't know what that was, they started showing up, and Dave Edmonds, who wound up being our record producer, and talking about rockabilly, rock and roll that existed before we got there. I mean, of course, there was a lot, but specifically sort of rockabilly influenced stuff, Dave Edmonds was really the king of. And he might have been at that same show with the Stones. And we got off the stage, and there was someone in our dressing room drinking the vodka. And we looked up and go, "That's Dave Edmonds." Well, wow, shit, you know? And he basically just said that he wanted to, besides that he loved the show, he wanted to produce the band, was he knew what we were doing, and he didn't want somebody else to come along and fuck it up. And that was it, really. We did use him for the first two records.
Well, you know what? How come those two records aren't, those first two European releases aren't available in the streaming services now?
Due to the situation where copyrights now, those records are more than 35 years old. So we're trying to business-wise recollect our masters.
Okay. So at some point they might become available, because well, for people listening that don't know, like there's a whole, it's like a whole another album's worth, because Built for Speed was like half of each of those records put together. So there's basically another album's worth of Stray Cat songs that we don't get on our streaming services.
Right. We don't get them here. And part of that also, I mean, there's that, the legality parts of it, but those first two Stray Cat records were just out in Europe. We only had a European, we didn't have a North American record deal. And so those records came out in England and all over Europe and Asia, and were big records. And it took us about 2 years to get a US deal. And at that point, they wanted to sort of cherry pick certain tracks.
So right.
Six off of Stray Cats, won another record, you know, and it was combined with things. It was more of a compilation record in a certain
sense. Yeah, it's so ironic that, like, you know, a band playing like the most American roots music got a deal in America last, an American band for that matter.
Yeah. I mean, it's a weird story. I mean, like I was telling you, I mean, just how things fell together, and we moved to England and got a deal, and the band took off. The U.S., the band really taking off in the States happened about 2 years. I'm terrible with years, but I'm thinking it was 2 years. Maybe it was one and a half. Maybe it was two and a half. Years later, when we were on a plane, British Airways flight from London to L.A., which we were starting – record labels were starting to call. Basically, with the Cats records were being sold in the U.S. on import, and they sold a lot of copies, and people started talking here in the States. And we're on this British Airways that was a pub flight they had back then, which was great. And
it was pub flight.
Yeah, there was a bar, there was a pub on the plane.
Oh, awesome!
And yeah, it was great. And so we got on the flight, and we're sitting in at the bar, and someone sitting next to us said, "You know, I'm the booker for a TV show called Fridays."
Right.
Fridays was like Saturday Night Live.
Yeah.
Long lived. But and this person was, you know, in the pub flight along with us, and said, "And I want to have you on the show." And they ran a ticker tape like they do on CNN now across the bottom while we were performing, saying, this band has sold whatever it was, 3 million copies of their first record and doesn't have a deal in the US. And they ran that across the screen. And now in hindsight, you know, I bet it wasn't a coincidence. I mean, what are the odds of that, you know? But that's kind of how they played it a little bit, like, oh, huh. Guess what?
Right. You think maybe in hindsight, like your manager was actually had been on the phone with them or whatever, you know,
or they figured it out or something.
Right. I mean,
funny ways.
So when Built for Speed took off here in the States, were you guys like, I mean, you'd already been touring those songs and working and playing those songs. We're like, ah, fuck, we want to make another record. Now we got to go do these same fucking songs for another 2 years. Or were you just so excited that it was blowing up that you didn't care?
I didn't care. I mean, and it was literally, it was like being shot out of a cannon the whole early years. So there was so little time to, you know, mull this over and analyze things and think about it, you know? But it was like being shot out of a cannon. It was crazy. It was insane, and it was great, and it was great fun.
Well, it was also coincided with the explosion of MTV that created this whole nother layer of music fame.
Yeah, we had done a few videos, Rock This Town, Stray Cat Strut, Runaway Boys in the UK before there was MTV. So we were one of the bands that when they started that, we were right there and ready to go.
Right.
MTV had a huge effect, completely. But, you know, the analogy being shot of the cannon thing, in some ways, it holds true how I think about things was if we would have slowed things down at some point or had proper management, which we never or rarely ever had, someone might have said, hey, guys, why don't you take 6 months off and write, or don't write, take a break, or, you know, think about things a little bit. And I think if that would have happened, or do solo work, do your own, go separate ways for X amount of time, probably wouldn't have been smarter and wouldn't have led to the pattern that we have with the Stray Cats, which is we do it and we all separate. And then 10 years later, this is more recent life, about every 10 years we get together and do a major tour or an album.
Well, you know, it's okay. So it's interesting. So I've interviewed Brian and I've interviewed Jim, but you know, before for my podcast, and they both said, if I recall, like basically exactly the same thing that you just said, like, fuck, if we had just taken a break, had a few months off to collect ourselves, you know, we probably wouldn't have broken up, you know? So let's talk about, like, from your point of view, why did the Stray Cats, I mean, I get it, you know, you're working, and then just, it gets frazzled, but what was the sort of specific moment that it sort of stopped being fun and that crept into it of like, fuck this, I want out?
It just the amount of time and the amount of work and you know, getting run down and needing a break. It seemed the only way to get a break was to do that. And that's fine. I mean, I have no regrets with anything. And really what's developed from that is this kind of a pattern that, you know, we're in touch with each other. We know each other since we're 10 years old. And every once in a while, we get together. Last year, 2019, we did a 40th anniversary tour. Yep. Did a lot of dates, did a first new album in a long time, and did a live record from the tour afterwards. And, you know, and then we go our separate ways and do our other stuff. And, you know, I think it's probably the best way in terms of creativity anyway, at this point. I have no regrets, but it, you know, everyone does a couple of different things, you know?
Sure. I mean, how, like when you guys work now, and you, like you said, you've got kind of big gaps between working, but I know you guys are all, obviously all still in contact, but you know, do those old tensions rear their head? Are you guys more like, you're just more mature with it? Like, all right, we're getting a little grumpy. Let's, like, time to wrap it up and we'll see you guys in a few years.
Yeah. The last couple of tours have been, for the most part, a lot of fun in a way, because now, and it's just, you know, life moves on, getting older, whatever. But I would say the last tour was magic on stage every night. And we're sort of almost on three different tours. We meet up at the venue.
Right.
You stand on the side of the stage, you wait to walk out together, which is, to me, is always an amazing feeling, like just that right before you go out, you know? Finish the show and see you at the next one, you know?
Yeah.
And that seems to work best.
That's good mature evolution.
Yeah. And it's
avoid the problems before they happen, man. That's good stuff.
Everyone's, you know, set in their ways and different people at this point, you know, hopefully we all as human beings change from the time they're 15 to the time they're 55, you know.
Yeah, but not that much. We don't change that much. Well, I hope that you guys do that again when the touring comes back, because I was so bummed. You know, I'm such a big fan and I've seen you guys a lot, but it's been a minute since I've seen you guys live, and I really wanted to see the reunion tour that you did, like you mentioned, a couple of years ago. And we were on tour all through that time, so I missed every Southland show.
Right. Well, we'll see what happens, but I'm an optimist. I think things are coming back and live concerts, and I just can't wait.
Sure.
And hopefully that will be part of it, you know?
Yeah. I hope. You know, when you talk about creatively, I'm curious about the songwriting side of things. And with rockabilly and a lot of like the sort of related roots music, they're sort of like, you know, there's specific forms, 1-4-5 type songs. Uh-huh. And in my opinion, writing those kind of songs is kind of like the hardest thing. It's easier to get over complicated with stuff, but when you're writing in that sort of traditional 1-4-5 kind of setup, it can be really hard. Like, how do you sort of breathe new life into those well-worn chord progressions?
You know, I do as a writer, you know, and that is true. Simplicity is not an easy thing in terms of structure like that, you know, but you know, I look for the fourth chord instead of three chords sometimes for a bridge.
Right.
And, you know, look for unique ways to work a melody through those kind of chord changes. Really. I operate in a bubble in a lot of ways, you know, and I love writing a song. I mean, there's one on the, there's 10, but there's one I'm just thinking about on my new record, Gather Round, which is Graceland Auctions. And when I finished it, it doesn't sound like it, but when I finished it, I go, damn, I wrote a song with two chords. And
great.
It was like, wow. And I said that I just recently, finally, after a year, got my solo band together for a week of rehearsals just to have some fun. And I said that to the guys and they all went and go, geez, you're right. And I never even noticed, you know? So it's just, you know, trying to find new ways to do things. I mean, I find that the same thing as a bass player, there's every once in a while I'll sit down and I'll play something and I'll go, why the hell didn't I think of that 15 years ago? It's just
right.
Moments, you know, I'm sure you find that.
Yeah.
Where you just go, really?
Yeah. I've been doing this wrong for 50 years. I mean, did your love of rockabilly and rock and roll lead you into other kind of related, you know, roots, you know, country, jazz, blues, like bluegrass, whatever? Did you go like, I love Elvis. What was Elvis listening to? Did you do that whole thing?
Absolutely. You know, and I love all sort of these, I guess, for lack of a better word, organic based music, whether it's bluegrass and country music, and try to bring elements of that into what I do as an artist as well. And, what they listen to is important too. And really I've been so fortunate. I mean, I spent a lot of time with a couple of the original rock and roll guys and had some great friendships. Carl Perkins was a dear friend. We'd done a ton of work together, done recordings and tours, and we even did the Porky's Revenge soundtrack. You know, and talking to Carl, and what a great guy and gentleman. And Scotty Moore, who was Elvis Presley's original guitar player.
Sure, sure. And,
you know, hopefully I picked up some things through osmosis and hanging around. And most importantly, I think, it was understanding that what those guys did and many others was breaking new ground, as opposed to, here's rockabilly. Oh, you got to do it this way. This is the right way. This is the wrong way. Hell, I mean, when Presley and Scotty Moore and Bill Black recorded Blue Moon of Kentucky, country people were outraged.
Right.
Music. And it is about doing your own thing with it, and continues to be.
Yeah, it's so easy to lose sight of how radical that music was when it started. I mean, I'm wondering now that, you know, now that you've been doing this for a long time, like, you know, what is your, in the same way that those guys that you're talking about, Scotty Moore and Carl Perkins, viewed you guys, how do you sort of, what's your relationship to the rockabilly stuff that's come after Stray Cats? Like, because it's gone on in a lot of different directions. You know, there seems like there's always a rockabilly scene somewhere. And a lot of it, at least maybe the bigger stuff, was more of a, maybe more aggressive blending punk rock or even metal and stuff kind of into it. Like, what's your sense of all that?
Yeah, I mean, there's some, you know, really talented people doing stuff. I love Jim Heath, Reverend Horton Heat.
Sure.
With Jim and Jimbo, you know, and then people taking it and doing Big Sandy and the Fly Wright Boys, another great group incorporating that, Tiger Army, J.D. McPherson. There's an active, great scene. And, you know, I'm definitely, I definitely listen and enjoy it, and like seeing what people are doing, you know. Imelda May, another one.
Funny. I just posted my Imelda May interview today. I just interviewed her like last week. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So there's a scene, and I have to say, and I think for, you know, I always do wonder, as we've been talking about rockabilly and putting the title on it, you know, sometimes I think that might not do it a good service by titling it, because some people just think, "Oh, I don't like rockabilly." Well, just listen. You don't have to put a title on it. John Fogerty, I rarely hear him referred to as a rockabilly artist. Creedence.
Right.
That's Willie Nelson, a lot of stuff, you know, but that's what they're doing.
Yeah. I mean, especially when you say Willie Nelson, like so much of that old honky tonk is so close to the rock and roll, you know, they're very closely related.
Maybe we better start calling it honky tonk again.
Yeah, I'm in, baby. Sign me up. Hey man, I am such a big fan, and it just really means a lot to me to get to talk to you. I really, really appreciate you taking the time today, man.
Thank you so much. And what are you doing? I don't know if this is on the record or not. Like, what's happening with Foo Fighters? Like,
we've been fairly busy, you know, through this time. We can, like everybody else, we kind of shut it down there for a while, but we've been doing this and that. We put out a record a couple of months ago, and you know, like everyone else, we're just waiting for touring to come back. So we'll probably, it seems like, you know, there's some optimism there, and I think there'll probably be like some shows here and there kind of stuff happening, but you know, a proper tour, it's anybody's guess.
Yeah, that's what I'm looking at my calendar and on the phone with my people going, hey, what can we shake loose at this point?
Yeah.
I've got a couple of early September. I think I've got four or five scattered things that, you know, might happen, but
here's the plan.
I'm a little bit, and I was on the Reverend Horton Heat's website this morning going, where are they going and what are they doing? You know?
Right. Exactly. I was just going to say, here's the plan. Jump in my van. We'll drive to Texas. We'll get a pickup band and we'll go do some fucking shows.
Exactly.
Boom. Problem solved. Awesome, man. Well, take care, brother. It was great to finally meet you. I've been following you for years, and, you know, it's just a real pleasure.
Appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Take care, man.
Take care.
All right, that was Mr. Lee Rocker on Walking the Floor. Make sure you check out his latest record, Gather Round. And this is normally the part in the podcast where I say, and I'll be back in a couple weeks, but I don't know if I'm going to be back in a couple weeks. I don't know what the hell I'm doing. Either way, if I don't come back in a couple weeks, then maybe I'll see you next year, and maybe it'll just be under the guise of something completely different. Either way, thank you for listening. Adios, amigos!